Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of February. What a phenomenally interesting show we're going to have this hour. I've been looking forward to it since earlier this month when the identity of the man in the car park with a twisted spine, the way that he died, his last moments, were announced at an extraordinary press conference at Leicester University.
Today, we bear witness to history. We peer 500 years into medieval times and literally reach into a grave.
Rarely have the conclusions of academic research been so eagerly awaited. Ladies and gentlemen, it is the academic conclusion of the University of Leicester that, beyond reasonable doubt, the individual exhumed at Greyfriars in September 2012 is indeed Richard III, the last Plantagenet King of England.
This hour, we'll be speaking with three individuals from the University of Leicester's Search for the King Richard III Project, and they are joining us in the broadcasting suite at the University of Leicester this hour of the show. Before I introduce them, may I please give you our phone number and our email address and our Facebook address, because I have a feeling that many of you were as astonished as I was to hear this news, and you've loved productions of Richard III that you've seen at American Players Theater and elsewhere, because it is so performed. And the story of what kind of king he really was has fascinated us for centuries. Did Shakespeare do him an injustice? Is that okay? Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Joining us from the broadcasting suite at the University of Leicester, Matthew Morris, site director at the University of Leicester's Archaeological Services. He is the archaeologist who first uncovered the remains of Richard III. Matthew Morris, thank you so much for being with us today. Hello.
Hi.
Sarah Knight is also joining us. Sarah is senior lecturer in Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the University of Leicester. Sarah, thank you for being with us.
Hello.
Hello. And also, Marianne Lund is a lecturer in Renaissance Literature at the University of Leicester. And Marianne, thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you for inviting me.
Give us a little history here, Matthew. Let's start with you. When did this search for Richard III project begin?
For the Richard III Society, it's been years in the making. For us at the university, since 2011 was when we were first asked to look into finding the location of the Greyfriars Church.
And you were the gentleman, I understand, who discovered the body, actually. Were you the one who thought, no, this can't be the guy?
Well, the problem was we found the body too soon in the excavation, and we hadn't found the friary, so it wasn't particularly a surprise in that we were looking for a church. We were expecting to find human remains, and until we actually started the excavation itself, we weren't expecting it to be anything more than just one of the many people buried in that church.
Mm-hmm. And when did you realize, Matthew, that you had something extraordinary?
Probably it was the very last thing, really. We'd found the trauma on the skull sort of fairly on in the excavation, but we'd sort of just sort of second-guessed ourselves, really, and thought, oh, anyone could have got hit on the head. It wasn't until we found the vertebrae themselves, the twisting of the vertebrae, and that was the very last thing we found on the skeleton, that we sort of had this moment where we thought, good grief, we may have actually done this.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been, just in the scheme of history, in history timeline, quite a remarkable discovery as well, isn't it? To have that kind of big find from somebody who we've seen plays about for so long and who's written about, and there he was because we didn't know where he was. So historically, it was a huge find.
Well, it's certainly very exciting. I get asked this a lot, and in terms of what it's contributed to archaeology, maybe it isn't as important as, say, Tutankhamun or something, but it's certainly one of the most exciting finds in recent years.
Mm-hmm. How important was it to find a direct descendant of, I believe it was Richard III's eldest sister, to confirm DNA? Is that when you really could pinpoint and say that this is Richard III?
Well, I think from our point of view, it was the icing on the cake. All the other evidence, and you have to take all the evidence together, was so compelling that even without the DNA, I think we'd have probably concluded that we'd found Richard III. But having that extra source of evidence, the genetic evidence, was really clinched it.
Mm-hmm. Sarah and Marianne, if you would both talk about this. Our vision of Richard III is of this man with a horrible deformity, a left arm that is terribly withered. Did the discovery of the body reaffirm what we have heard about, particularly in Shakespeare?
Well, I think that you've got to take Shakespeare as well as the earlier Tudor histories, which depict Richard's physical disabilities. Certainly there's evidence that Shakespeare exaggerates a great deal. And when you set that against the remains, well, for the first time, really, you're able to compare the literature, the history, and the archaeology.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that some things are borne out in some ways by the discovery, but other things, there's no evidence at all. For instance, there's no sign that he had this withered arm. Shakespeare has him walking with a limp, and there's no sign of a limp. So it does show how history and literature diverge, as well as the truth that they do have in common.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, we think of him as one of the largest villain in all of literature. He is portrayed as an incredibly, in many performances, an incredibly evil person. Is that true about him, or do we have any historical knowledge of what kind of king he actually was?
We do have quite a lot of historical records, which you've got to weigh against each other and always look at who's writing them and what their agenda might have been.
Mm-hmm.
To deal with the idea of villainy first, there's no doubt that Shakespeare's portrait has cemented Richard as that villain in the popular imagination, if you like, and that performances of the play have, I mean, for example, Laurence Olivier's performance mid-20th century have helped to cement that view. But what you get from the historical sources is a somewhat more complicated picture. Certainly some of the earlier Tudor sources do emphasise what they represent as Richard's bad qualities. But the other thing to point out, I suppose, is that while Shakespeare undoubtedly is creating a villain, he's also creating a tremendously charismatic and eloquent character at the same time. So he's not a cartoon baddie, if you like.
He does have some pretty good lines, doesn't he?
He absolutely does. From the very beginning of the play, now is the winter of our discontent, Richard takes the stage and holds it. He has this wonderful soliloquy, a monologue on his own on the stage. And I think right till the very end, for the you know, horse a horse, my kingdom for a horse, Richard's the one that we're watching and we're magnetised by, I suppose.
What will, if anything, the discovery of the body and the shape of the body and what we've learned about how he died in battle do to change the historical record about Richard III? Will it add to our knowledge of him in a significant way?
It's going to add to our knowledge of how he looked. Certainly the facial reconstructions are absolutely fascinating and have a pretty close resemblance with his portraits. It's going to tell us quite a lot more about the exact circumstances of how he died. The historical accounts all talk about him being killed in the thickest press of the enemy of his enemies, and that's Polydore Vergil, shortly after Richard's death. So we can see from the trauma on the skeleton that he was really hacked about.
Mm.
It's not going to tell us anything more about his character, of course, and that's significant.
Mm-hmm. Can you add to that, Matthew, can you talk more about the discovery of the body and how we learned about his war wounds?
In terms of the individual, we're going to learn a lot about his physical appearance, his diet, what happened to him in the very last moments. But in a wider context as well, because we know who this person is, we have a name and a set of a life to go with it, which we is incredibly rare to be able to find in archaeology. Most of the skeletons we excavate, we'll never know who they were. We can't put a name to them, and therefore we can't put a biography to them. In this instance, everything we learn from Richard's skeleton in terms of diet, in terms of health, these are going to give us a brilliant baseline against which we compare other unnamed individuals. So how does his diet vary as a king and someone of very high status? How does his diet vary from people of very poor status, possibly? Can we tell differences? And that is going to be the genuine contribution to archaeology, I think, in this.
I read somewhere that so far radiocarbon dating, and tell me how this has progressed, suggests that Richard III ate a lot of seafood, which was a nod to an aristocratic kind of lifestyle. How in the world do we know he ate a lot of seafood?
Sorry, could you repeat that again? You cut out.
Oh, I'm sorry. That radiocarbon dating showed that Richard III ate a lot of seafood. How do we know that?
Right. I'm by no means an expert on this, but carbon, it's a study of the different levels of carbon isotopes in the bodies, C14, C13, and when you consume seafood, the carbon ratios in seawater are different to terrestrial samples. And so you can tell this different by looking at the isotope levels in the body, and what the results suggest is that this person had a very high marine diet, so seafood. It also shows that he had a, within his terrestrial diet, he was eating a lot of meat. It was a very high protein diet. Mm-hmm. High protein, a lot of meat, that suggests someone of very high status, or high status at the very least. Mm-hmm. Poorer people wouldn't be able to afford to consume as much meat as the rich.
What did you do with the remains when you found them, Matthew, and where will they eventually be buried? Is there a controversy about that I heard about a couple weeks ago?
Well, for some there's a controversy over this. The remains are currently in the University of Leicester. And as it stands at the minute, because the decision is down to University of Leicester, and the agreement before we started this project was mm-hmm. that any remains we'd find would be reinterred in Leicester Cathedral. That's the accepted line. The people at York are hoping for something different, though.
Well, you guys did all the work.
Quite right. If they wanted to find him, they could have come and looked for him, but they didn't.
Yeah, they've had 500 years to come and look for him. And they didn't.
He hasn't moved anywhere.
That's funny. Tell me, before we start going to phone calls, both Sarah and Marianne, let's start with you, Sarah. Why is it that this particular play is Shakespeare's most performed play, is my understanding, and why is it that we are absolutely fascinated by this king?
I think, to consider Shakespeare first, from the time of its first performance in the early 1590s, it seems to have captured the imagination of various successive audiences. And even though theatre tastes have changed so much over the intervening centuries, this is a play, I suppose, with its themes of power, villainy, dysfunctional families, turbulent political history. There's supernatural elements. There's a visitation of ghosts. There are curses. There's a lot of elements in it to make it, I think, so continuously popular to audiences of all backgrounds. At the time it would have been performed to a mixed audience, from people who are illiterate right up into the very elite, and it seems to have appealed to everybody. So I think there's a lot in the play to capture different people's imaginations, and I suspect that's the reason for why it's been performed so often.
Is there historical evidence that he was as vicious as he was? Probably most notably is to murder his little nephews in the Tower.
Well, the historical record gets quite complicated around that question. Mm. I mentioned earlier the Tudor sources right from the start of the 16th, late 15th century, and some of our earliest historical records are, if you like, commissioned, written for the winners. These are the histories by Thomas More, for example, and Polydore Virgil, are expressly written in the early years of the reign of Henry VII, so the person who defeats Richard at the Battle of Bosworth. So if we're looking for early historical evidence of villainy, there's obviously going to be a case made for that in histories written under those early Tudor circumstances.
We are going to invite our audience to join this interesting conversation. Our guests are joining us from the broadcasting suite at the University of Leicester. The university conducted a search for Richard III Project, and they found Richard III's remains. You remember this story from earlier this month. Three of the people who are on the project and who have a deep understanding of Renaissance literature and Shakespeare, who has defined Richard III for many of us, and also we're speaking with the archaeologist who first uncovered the body of Richard III. Our guests are Matthew Morris, site director, University of Leicester Archaeological Services. He is the archaeologist who first uncovered the remains of Richard III. Sarah Knight is a senior lecturer in Shakespeare and Renaissance literature at the University of Leicester, and Marianne Lund is a lecturer in Renaissance literature at the same university. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. With your calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for our discussion of the finding of King Richard III, his place in history, his portrayal by William Shakespeare, and a host of marvelous actors who have given us a pretty strong identity of Richard III that may indeed be wrong. 800-486-8655 is our number. Saul in Stevens Point is our first caller for you, everybody in England. Hello, Saul.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Not sure yet. No, I'm fine. I looked at the pictures, you know, the excavation, while the bones are still in the ground, and then as they were laid out, and the scyphosis, the curvature of the spine is very pronounced. But I wonder, it didn't look quite right to me. I'm wondering who actually did the diagnosis of scyphosis on the skeleton.
Matthew?
Okay. The diagnosis of the scoliosis is by the osteologist Joe Appleby and a colleague of hers, Piers Mitchell, who is an expert in the subject.
Usually... scyphosis is more the hunchback, you know, it's in the sagittal plane, you know what I mean? And whereas scoliosis is off to the side, kind of looking at an S as you face the person.
This is scoliosis.
Is this going to be published? That'll kind of answer my question.
Yes, it will be all published this year sometime. I don't have an exact date when it will be published, but it will be all published in peer-reviewed journals this year.
Thank you, Saul, for the call. I want to hear about the moments, actually, Matthew, when you found these remains. What you thought? Did you walk away? Did you come back? When did you realize, I have a big thing here? Who did you notify? What did you do?
Well, during the actual discovery, I mean, other than the sort of good grief we might have done at the moment, we were sort of so focused on actually exhuming the skeleton that we didn't really have time to think about the significance. It had been an incredibly long day. We'd been on site 8 o'clock that morning, and we'd finished the exhumation at 7 o'clock that night with the sun going down. And it wasn't until driving home that evening I sort of had first moment to unwind, and it suddenly started sinking in the significance of what it could be.
Mm-hmm. You really didn't believe it at first, because why?
It just seemed so improbable that we'd actually managed to do it. Of the friary precinct, and we didn't know where the church was or anything before we started. We knew where the precinct was, but we didn't know where the buildings were inside. The excavation itself looked at just 1% of the friary precinct. And the amount of luck that 1%, you know, put targeting everything and all the results we managed to find is just incredible. But yeah, at the time it just seemed so improbable that we'd managed to do it.
Mm-hmm. Will you find other things? Did you find anything else close to King Richard III?
So the grave itself has nothing in it other than the body. There's no evidence of a coffin or shroud or any personal ornaments or anything like that. And unfortunately, the rest of the area it was found in is quite heavily damaged by other buildings over the last couple of hundred years. But in the other trenches, we found other bits of the church and the friary buildings. We've found medieval coins. We've found, including one of his brother, Edward IV.
Really?
Yeah. We found big fragments of a very grand early Perpendicular-style window that's probably from somewhere in the east end of the church. And this is actually important in that before we started the excavation, we knew nothing about Greyfriars itself, the friary. So the genuine contribution of this excavation has really been to finding out more about the friary. We went into this knowing nothing. Now we know enough that we can actually start reconstructing bits of it, which is incredibly useful. It's an important building in Leicester that we've known nothing about up to this point.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You didn't find any remnants of a horse, of course.
Sadly not, no.
No.
Although there are a few in British supermarkets, from what we understand. Recent
really?
News reports. Yes, yes, that's the other big news of the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, tell me how people in Leicester are taking in this news. Are people talking about it all over? And
there's a huge excitement about it here in Leicester. The local radio had Richard III Day. And they couldn't stop talking about it. And I think there's a real sense of attachment and ownership towards Richard, which is really fascinating to witness. I think a lot of people who grew up in the area learnt about these legends of Richard after his death, being brought back from the battlefield to Leicester, and a story of his body having been thrown in the river. So now we know that's not true, of course,
right.
but it's interesting how these legends come about.
Let's go to Laura in Madison next. Hi, Laura.
Oh, thank you so much for this exciting program. I have two questions. One, could you first give just a little bit of more basic background on why he was missing, how he went missing? How does a King of England's body, how do people not know where it is? Why and how did this important friary just disappear so that you had to excavate it and it's not there anymore? The second question is it true what I have read that academics now think that the whole story about Richard being evil and putting the two princes in the tower and executing them was completely false, that it was trumped up by the people who took over from him who actually did kill the princes? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Laura.
Okay, I guess the first one's for me to answer. We know that he was buried in a friary building in the church, in the choir of the church in 1485. The problem is that 50 years later, Henry VIII dissolves the monasteries. As part of that, he strips out all the valuable stuff, the lead off the roofs, anything that you can sell for a profit. And the rest of the building, the ruin, is just left to either fall down or the building material itself is used to build other buildings in town. And in Leicester, building stone is quite scarce. So anything that's available, people will take and use elsewhere. So the church itself disappears quite quickly after 1538. And the site becomes the land gets bought by a man called Robert Herrick. He was a mayor of Leicester. And he turns the site into his house and gardens. And then over the next couple hundred years, the site just gets more and more subdivided, more houses built on it, more buildings built on it, until the knowledge of where the grave was just becomes lost. And it's not unusual. It's Richard III is not the only English king that's missing. I think there's about eight that we've misplaced over the years. So.
About the second question about Richard's villainy, discovering his body doesn't tell us anything about what kind of man he was. So the evidence is, as Sarah Knight said, rather troubling, and a lot of the accounts have been written after his death when it was in the interests of Henry VII to blacken Richard's character. And that's when the story of the Princes of the Tower, the murders of the Princes of the Tower, really comes to prominence. Now, we just don't know whether that's true or not. And of course, if he did do it, it'd be in his interests not to have that information in the open air when he was on the throne. So I don't think that we're going to get any farther at the moment to understanding what kind of person he was. Mm. But I think it does open all sorts of new possibilities.
And again, I mean, we perhaps have Shakespeare to blame for the vividness with which the story of the Princes in the Tower has seized people's imaginations. Shakespeare's Richard, quite explicitly, is implicated in their murder. And I think, again, that's one of the more colourful anecdotes or rumours or stories from Richard's reign that we've inherited.
Were there not any to-be-believed, reliable contemporary biographers of Richard III?
He was only on the throne for a very short time, only a couple of years, so there's not time to write a biography of his kingship while he's on the throne. And that's the issue. And of course, the idea of historical reliability is in itself very problematic, because it is always written with some kind of an agenda.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that there are some very sort of fragmentary accounts from before 1485. But what you also get, and this is there in the manuscript evidence, is the kind of doctoring of these accounts after Henry VII's victory. I mean, you can see words being crossed out or the words being substituted. So the historical record becomes unstable, even at the level of the text.
Hmm. Harold Bloom in Our Country wrote a piece after this discovery saying that he wondered if all of Richard III was not a deliberate parody of both Tudor propaganda and of Christopher Marlowe's art of caricature. What do you make of that?
That's a really interesting perspective. I mean, I think it's fair to say that in the history plays, Shakespeare's very interested in exploring how propaganda works and how different ideologies get dramatised, how different monarchs get represented in particular ways because they were victorious. As a response to Marlowe, it would make sense in the 1590s, where Marlowe is probably Shakespeare's single biggest rival model influence. I'd have to think a bit more about that specifically in relation to Richard III, though.
It's an interesting question, because I don't think Shakespeare is in any way an apologist for Elizabeth's reign. In fact, he writes Richard II, which is a play about usurping, about Richard II being taken off the throne by Henry IV, which is used as part of a coup attempt against Elizabeth by the Earl of Essex. So he's not this incredibly pro-Elizabeth person. And she is, of course, the granddaughter of Henry. So the idea that Richard III is this vehemently pro-Tudor propaganda piece just doesn't really quite work in the terms of Shakespeare's theatrical biography.
Mm. Let's go to Joe next in Viola. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thank you for this show, and thank you for all your work. It's amazing, and I hope it really reinvigorates people to appreciate Shakespeare. My question is, in relation to the last question about propaganda, it seems that all these history plays at this time throughout the 1580s and 90s were basically the first attempt at state propaganda, and using the medium of theater to, as you said, push the Tudor propaganda piece. I'm curious about your theories or your thoughts about the author himself, the Stratford man, and his lack of biographical information, the fact that his daughters were illiterate, the fact that there's no evidence of him having any education. And I'm curious whether you think there's any credence to looking into the various authorship theories, especially the 17th Earl of Oxford, who seems to have a lot more evidence behind him being the author of the plays, and certainly people like Sir Derek Jacobi and Mark Rylance and historical people, Henry James, Sigmund Freud, Supreme Court justices in the United States also feel this way.
Well, I don't think there's any credence for these stories. There is actually, for a man who lived in the late 16th century, an awful lot of biographical information about Shakespeare. He wasn't illiterate. He was actually pretty well educated by the standards of the day. He went to grammar school, where he would have studied classical literature. He would have known Latin fairly well, and the evidence from the plays definitely bears that out. He was also living in London, living in the theatre scene and interacting with lots of the other people who were writing plays. We know that he was reading all kinds of classical works through his publisher. So I think, you know, the arguments that have been put against William Shakespeare of Stratford writing his plays don't really hold a lot of water. Given that there is no sense, really, that he has to have experienced something in order to have written about it.
And to add to that, a lot of the Tudor dramatists are from the provinces, and not all of them go to university. So you've got someone like Marlowe being brought up relatively low status in Canterbury, going to Cambridge on a scholarship. Then you've got someone like Ben Jonson, who, like Shakespeare, never goes to university. So the trajectory that we might perhaps expect for someone from that period is one, I think, that's not necessarily borne out by the evidence. And as Marianne says, we know that Shakespeare goes to grammar school. We know that the argument is that if you go to grammar school in the Tudor period, that you have a, by our standards, extraordinarily high level of Latin after that. So it's credible that Shakespeare has access to the sources that he then weaves into fictionalized drama.
Matthew, I'm wondering about the burial now of Richard III. How is there a proper protocol of how you bury a king you found 500 years after he died?
Kathleen, sorry, I have to interrupt you there. Matthew just had to leave, I'm afraid.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you, Matthew. I know you had to. Thank you, Matthew. Do either of you know the answer?
So what was the question? It was about protocol.
What's the proper burial for a king who's discovered 500 years after he dies?
Well, there's absolutely no precedent for this.
I would imagine.
And that's what's fascinating. Now, we think that he probably had a funeral already. So he wouldn't have a funeral. He would be officially a reinterment, an interment ceremony. And that's planned for early next year. But I suspect it's going to be a very big thing. And I imagine a lot of people are going to want to go to that. And
yes,
it could. I'm sure it will be televised as well.
Yes.
And my understanding is at the moment that the debate about the exact form that the reinterment should take and how it will be marked, physically marked within the building, that's something that's being debated at the moment.
They're just designing tombstones, in fact, over the next month.
Really? Are they in competition or something?
I think they're submitting their proposals to architects to ask exactly what. But the Richard III Society, who were behind the origins of this search, have just shown the pictures of something that they envisage.
I also have read that the Richard III project almost ran out of money, that this discovery perhaps would not have been made because you were low on funds. Is that right?
I understand that at one point there was an issue with one of the funders, but then I think a sort of, you know, public funding appeal worked, and that helped to top things up and keep things moving.
That's right. Quite a large amount of the funding for this project came from the University of Leicester, but supplemented by Leicester City Council, and, as Sarah says, some private donations, particularly from the Richard III Society. So it's really nice that this whole project has come about through lots of people, but it's really something communal.
Yes. Joe, thanks for your call. Let's go to Jean in Oshkosh next. Hi, Jean.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen. It's so nice to talk to you and your guests from across the pond. I wish I had more information to use to even ask this question, but I went to an all-boys high school. And Kathleen, you know it, down in Milwaukee. And I saw a movie on Richard III. And when I think of terrible deaths, in my mind, I can picture the actor lying on the ground, jerking one way and the other as he goes through the death throes. Do your guests have any idea what movie I saw and who was the actor playing Richard III?
Well, that's a tough guess. I mean, of the film versions, do you have a sense of the year or decade in which you saw this?
Well, I would have been, in the 1940s.
It may have been. Just thinking about this, I mean, there are some. Was it a silent film or a sound film?
I beg your pardon. Was that a question? Our connection is not that good.
Was it a sound or a silent film, Gene? Gene? Let's say it was either a sound or a silent film. I don't know.
I suspect it was Laurence Olivier's version.
Probably would be. Yeah, no, the reason I ask is that Marianne and I have recently had the opportunity to see a quite rare 1912 film, which was one of the first feature films made in the US, I believe, and it's a silent feature-length version of Richard III. So that was where my question was coming from. Apparently he's been there right from the history of cinema. But I'd agree with Marianne. I think it's more likely to be the Laurence Olivier film, which until the Ian McKellen film right at the end of the 20th century was probably the single most celebrated film version of Richard III.
He's a very sort of calculating villain in that film, and I think that's the memory that most people have of Richard.
It was quite a performance, wasn't it? Laurence Olivier's. It really was.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jean. I hope that helped you. We have some emails to read. We have more phone calls coming in. We're having just a rip-roaring great hour here. We're talking about the discovery of the body of Richard III, who died in battle in 1485. And researchers from the University of Leicester's Search for Richard III project are with us this hour. The archaeologist had to go teach. We are speaking, though, with Sarah Knight, senior lecturer in Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the university, and Marianne Lund, who's a lecturer in Renaissance Literature. They're both at the University of Leicester, and we're talking more now about how Richard III has been portrayed in brilliant films and also on stage. American Players Theatre did a great Richard III last summer. And how our information now about how he died and who he was will be greater because of the discovery of this body, but it calls into question how we think about history and the influence of Shakespeare in making him the world's perhaps largest villain, one of the world's largest villains. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guests are joining us from the broadcasting suite at the University of Leicester. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that's come in from Kathleen. After the Battle of Bosworth, the people of York put into their public records, "This day was our good King Richard piteously slain and murdered to the great heaviness of this city. Not the epitaph of a hated schemer, he's been slandered for years." Huh? Is that true?
Depends who you want to believe, I suppose. They certainly said that. There were people who said some pretty strong things against him as well. There was a famous story of someone who said that Richard was a crookback who died in a dyke like a dog. So there's all kinds of unpleasantness about Richard at the same time. We have to look at all of the evidence and weigh it up very carefully.
Right. Let's go to Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Actually, I have two comments. The first one has to do with the fact that I'm very interested in the the palace that was built by Henry VIII called Nonsuch. And I'm wondering if any money at all is allocated in England for trying to find where that was exactly and bring it back to life, if anything at all of it exists anymore. And the other question I have is, it's very interesting to me that King Richard III was the last king who died in battle. Were, after that death occurred, were other kings protected from getting so advanced in the battle that they might have been killed?
Oh, that's interesting.
Those are two really interesting questions, actually. I mean, first of all, with Nonsuch Palace, I don't know specifically of any funding drives at the moment to locate that palace, but I know that certainly in this country there are a lot of historians, architectural historians, art historians, garden historians who would support that. It's a tremendously interesting place. But I don't know anything more specifically about whether there are any campaigns at the moment. And could you repeat the second question again, please?
That had to do with the fact that King Richard, as you said, was the last king to be slain in battle. And after that happened, were kings no longer allowed to be so far advanced in the battles that they, in other words, they were protected from ever being killed? That was the killing of King Richard III a wake-up call that perhaps we better be protecting our kings better?
I think this speaks to a point that Marianne made earlier on. All the accounts agree that Richard was in the very thick of the battle. Now, whether that was a question of circumstance, whether that was design, all we have are the records that tell us that he was in the middle of things when he died. It may well be that subsequent kings did learn from that example. Certainly in the civil wars in the mid-17th century, we don't have similar circumstances. But I'm not sure whether further future kings were sort of going specifically by what happened to Richard or not.
Hmm. It's very interesting, actually, that In the accounts which are hostile towards Richard, they still say that he was very brave in battle, and that he was offered the chance to escape the battlefield, that he was offered a swift horse so that he could get out, but that he said no, that he wanted to stay and solve this, that he would either die or secure his reign. So the idea of him actually being in the thick of things is part of his way of asserting his right to the throne.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you very much for the call. Do either of you know why Shakespeare decided to devote an entire play to Richard III?
Well, Shakespeare was very interested in the Wars of the Roses anyway. He'd written a trilogy of plays about Henry VI. You could think of his particular interest in this in late 1580s, early 1590s, as during a very long reign of Elizabeth I. It's interesting to look at lots of short, exciting, unstable reigns by comparison. But there's actually a wider interest in English theatre at this period, in the Wars of the Roses, and particularly in Richard III. We know of at least one other English play about Richard III, and there's a Latin play that was performed by students at Cambridge, which includes Richard's death, and he's brought in on thrown over the back of a horse. So I think Richard himself is a figure, an object of real fascination throughout the 16th century and indeed beyond. So for us, Shakespeare is what creates this very magnetic character. But I think that magnetic character is something that had already arisen.
I have read that Richard III, that Shakespeare's principal source was a Tudor source, Sir Thomas More's The History of King Richard III. Is that true?
Well, what Shakespeare does, we think that there's his go-to historical source for the majority of the English history plays is this work called Chronicles by the Tudor historian Raphael Holinshed. Hmm. So this first comes out in 1577 and a second edition gets published in 1587. Now, what Holinshed does is to combine a lot of the earlier Tudor sources and, if you like, sort of create a patchwork of all the different accounts of Richard's reign. So Thomas More, interestingly, I mean, he writes his account of his history of Richard III in the mid-1510s. And he writes it in two versions. He writes an English version and a Latin version, but they don't get printed until the mid-16th century, where more people have access to them. And there's also this history that I mentioned earlier by Polydore Virgil, the Historia Anglica. Now, Virgil probably starts this in the first decade of the 16th century. An English translation of that gets produced mid-16th century as well. And all of these, if you like, are channeled into Holinshed's Chronicles, and that's where Shakespeare goes first. But he's also using this account of the Wars of the Roses from the 1540s by the historian Hall. So Shakespeare, you know, is something of a magpie when it comes to his sources. But it seems that Holinshed was also appropriating lots of different histories as well. So, I mean, that's the way I would trace the chain of influence there.
Thank you, Nancy, for your call. Bill in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I read a biography of Richard III, and listening to you talk about Shakespeare always painting him in a very poor light, this biography, was written by Paul Kendall, shows that Richard III was quite an interesting and a good person earlier in life. His brother was on the throne, Edward IV, and Richard was given of the, I think the word was governorship of the area, the northern area of England around York. And he did a fine job up there. The people liked him and liked the way he governed it. I was just wondering if you have any comments on those particular statements.
Well, that's absolutely right. He was also responsible for all kinds of important legal reforms, improving British justice, and some of the things that he's brought in, like the system of bail, for instance, which are now still in force, of course, today. So he was responsible for a great deal of, in terms of the good things. And those, of course, have not been the subject of drama, and have, I suppose, been reduced when the villainous portrait of Richard has tended to replace them. But he has had his advocates from way back then. There is an early 17th century historian called George Buck who really defends Richard and against all of these accusations flung against him. And then again in the 19th century, early 20th century, and perhaps quite a few of your listeners will know Josephine Tay's novel, The Daughter of Time, which is about a detective who's in hospital, is a bit of a loss of what to do with his time, and looks at all of the historical sources and decides that Richard is, in fact, not a villain, and that he has been sort of unjustly treated over the centuries.
There's evidence as well that in the 1590s, one historian, John Stowe, who writes a work of history called The Annals, tried to find people who had known Richard to get a fuller sense of his reign. Stowe seems to have been quite scrupulous in seeking out, as he described, well, as George Buck describes them, actually, old and grave men who had seen Richard, to almost as though at the end of the 16th century there's an interest to think back over the last century's worth of historical accounts of Richard and see if there are any other perspectives that are available.
I have a feeling there will be many more historical accounts about Richard III in the next couple of years, don't you think?
I'm sure you're right, yes.
Yes, I think there will be. Well, this has just been absolutely fascinating. We thank you here across the pond for all of your time and all of your work on this. It was a fascinating discovery, and you were terrific. Thank you.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, our
thank
great
you.
Pleasure. Our guests from the Search for the Richard III Project, joining us from the broadcasting suite at the University of Leicester. Sarah Knight, senior lecturer in Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the university there, and Marianne Lund, who's a lecturer in Renaissance Literature. We also thank Matthew Morris, site director of the Archaeological Services at the university. He was the archaeologist who first uncovered the remains of Richard III.